Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, first day of spring, the 20th of March. The horrors of war this hour of the program as we begin to learn more about Staff Sergeant Robert Bales, who is accused of the massacre of Afghan villagers. And as we examine whether or not we should be in Afghanistan, we thought this hour that we would talk with a veteran to find out the horrors of war. If indeed, as the Harvard Medical School psychiatrist who heads the post-traumatic stress research laboratory at Massachusetts General Hospital, if it's true, as he says, that we've known ever since Vietnam that the unfortunate phenomena of abusive violence often closely follows the injury or death of a buddy in combat. The injury or death of a buddy creates a kind of blind rage. Post-traumatic stress disorder has been brought up in association with this case, as has the horrors of war, and we have a guest who has been to Iraq to talk about all of this the first hour of our program today. Zach Laporte is an Iraq war veteran, a former machine gun team leader in an infantry platoon for the U.S. Army. He was sent to Iraq in the spring of 2005. He served from April to June of that year as part of a special combat unit that is deployed for 3 months at a time, redeployed in the fall of 2006, returned home in January of 2007. He joined Iraq Veterans Against the War 2 years ago, and he has been to the VA for screening. He was screened for traumatic brain injury as well as post-traumatic stress. The test concluded that he had some signs of traumatic brain injury. He lives in Franklin and works in Brookfield. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. I'm particularly interested in hearing from vets who have served in Afghanistan or served in Iraq to talk about the horrors of war in those fields of operation, and also to look at whether or not the horrors of war can result in somebody just losing his mind and committing such a horrible act of atrocity. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Zach, good morning. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. We're asking you to take on a lot during the course of this hour, but I think you're up to the task. What were your responses when you first heard about this massacre in Afghanistan? Did you immediately think, how in the world could such a horrible event happen? Or did you think that, considering the stress that soldiers are facing, something like this could happen?
My first response when I heard about it, I was definitely shocked. You know, you never hear about a soldier going off on a massacre like this, at least even to this magnitude. I mean, there's always accidental discharges and firings and stuff like that, where it's, you know, a blatant accident or a accidental occurrence. However, this was pretty blatant, and I was pretty shocked by it.
Mm-hmm. It certainly has made us reexamine again, but in a heightened way, our involvement in Afghanistan. Is that good?
I agree. Yeah, we definitely have to examine every time we occupy a country. And let's get this correct. I mean, this is an occupation. Every time we do this, we have to look and figure out, you know, if this is really worth it. Is this something that we should be doing? And I'm unfortunately, this had to happen for people to open up this dialogue of what exactly are we doing there.
For those of us who have not served, it's incomprehensible what has to happen within your mind to train yourself for the act of killing. Can you tell me what it was like for you when you were sent to Iraq in the spring of 2005, how you had to prepare yourself, and if you can ever prepare yourself for the task at hand?
Well, when you first join the military, they try and desensitize you in basic training to what could potentially be the act of killing another human being. And every soldier, man or woman, goes through the same type of training. And when you get to your to your given unit after you go through basic training, there is a certain mentality that they try to instill in you of fearlessness, and they don't want you to feel any type of fear at all. And it's really, the way I like to compare, you know, a lot of military, especially infantry and special forces units, are they're somewhat of a fraternity where it's largely male dominated, testosterone and aggressiveness, and they try and kind of weed out the ones that they don't think can do it. And there's a lot of open discussion with soldiers that have already deployed, and they usually try and prepare you, but nothing really prepares you. I can't say that I felt prepared when I deployed.
No. Why did you go?
Why did I join?
Mm-hmm.
I joined for various reasons. You know, the college money is attractive.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of patriotism, I think, is what really pulled me in, and I sense of duty. I felt like I was obligated. You know, I watched the Iraq invasion. I watched it from my, you know, I went to college for 1 year. I watched it from a dorm room. I was 19 years old, and I somehow felt like I had an obligation and duty to serve.
And did that guiding thought, which was a strong one for everybody who saw what happened on that day, did that help you in some way to carry out a mission in Iraq?
Well, the things that you're told on the news and all the types of propaganda that you hear and read about, they don't accurately portray what goes on in the country. You know, if you just pay attention to the news, you'd think that the country was completely war-torn. You know, and there's, you know, you hear a bombing of 16 people dying or 20 or 30 or whatever, and I mean, it's horrific. But in all reality, you know, you get to the country and it's I shouldn't say peaceful, but the intensity of the combat there is not necessarily what you would think it is from, you know, where I was watching it in my dorm room. I watched the Shock and Awe air campaign, and it wasn't like that.
It wasn't as intense, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Did you see horrible things?
Yes, I did. I saw a few. I didn't lose any combat. I didn't lose any of my friends during combat. However, I did witness several, what I would consider, war crimes.
And you were there, you were redeployed. You were there in 2005, and then you returned in 2006.
Yeah, I had, my unit is somewhat of a special type of unit that I served with, and we deployed for 3 months at a time, every 6 months, so it was about a 9 month long cycle, and we were back in the United States for six months, and then we would deploy for 3 months, and we were based out of Fort Lewis, Washington, the same base of the soldier that committed the shooting last weekend.
Mm-hmm. And when you think about redeployments, how hard is it to go through one, two? Should there be a limit, do you think, on how much one person can take, or can people take many deployments?
You know, it's tough even to go one time, and it's especially tough on your family. I mean, a lot of guys in my company, in my battalion, they had problems dealing with the thought of redeploying, being separated from their families, and I had a fellow soldier that actually, he came back from his 10th deployment. He had deployed 10 times.
Oh my gosh, 10 times. Woo.
10 times, and he was seeking help for what he said was, you know, post-traumatic stress. And he was set to go on his 11th deployment. And this last summer, he was scheduled to go on his last deployment to, or his next deployment to Afghanistan. And he ended up killing himself during a live fire training exercise. Because he was not allowed to seek help, and he told his wife that God would never forgive him for the things that he had done.
Mm. That's a horrible, horrible story.
It is, but it's the truth of what goes on in a soldier's mind, you know, when he's asked to repeatedly deploy. I mean, a soldier that's been on 10 3-month deployments, that's 30 months. That's 2.5 years of his life that he has spent carrying out these missions.
You sought help when you came home as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I went to the VA hospital and asked for, they have these yearly, they send out annual, they ask you to come annually to the VA hospital. Unfortunately, that's only if you're registered with the hospital. You have to physically go into the hospital. You have to register, and then they have these annual screenings, and it wasn't until my second annual screening that I actually kind of raised a hand and said, "Hey, you know, I should probably talk to somebody."
Why did you say that? Why did you say?
I was just having a really tough time dealing with some of the things that I'd seen and done, and you know, I had another fellow soldier who I was with who had gone to the VA to seek help, and he said, "Hey, Zach, you should really go to the VA hospital and maybe you should talk to somebody."
And did you get help? Did you feel better after you had done so?
Yeah, I talked to a counselor that I talked to, and I talked to her for about 6 months, and about once a week, maybe once every couple weeks. And along with that, you know, I was having an open dialogue with my friend who I said had also sought help at the VA, and through that I was able to kind of come to grips with things and not let it dominate my life. You know, I mean, it never goes away. You're never going to forget the things you've seen and done, but there are ways of coping with it.
You were deployed twice for your friend who committed suicide or for others who have been deployed more than twice and have strong reservations about being redeployed again and make their thoughts known to their superiors. Is any consideration given to that? Can somebody listen to you when you say, "I just can't do this again"?
There's kind of a mentality where if you feel mentally unstable or unable to go and do that again, there's kind of that you know, they it's almost like a demeaning. You know, if you try and seek out help, you know, they kind of look at you like you can't handle it. You're mentally unfit, and I think that's really horrible, because when I got back from my second deployment, one of my privates that was associated with my he was basically right below me in my machine gun team,
mm-hmm.
And I got a call from his. We went on leave for 2 weeks right after deployment, and I got a call from his dad the day that we were supposed to report back. And I said, you know, I said, "Where is he? Where's Hodgkins?" And his dad said, "He's not going to be able to come in. He's having issues." And I didn't really understand what he was talking about. And then he said, he told me that he was thinking about suicide.
Mm.
And I felt awful about that, because he had been in my team, and he was my responsibility. And so, once he came in, you know, I saw to it. I took him down to the, well, He had already been admitted to the hospital, and so I went down to visit him, but it was only a couple months after that he actually got discharged out of the military.
We're just getting initial reports about the soldier, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales, who was accused of this horror. The New York Times on Monday wrote a lengthy front-page story, and I quote here, "There are glimpses of a darker storyline. Sergeant Bales' past includes an arrest on a misdemeanor charge of assault on a woman, dropped after he completed anger management counseling, an accident in which he overturned his car, something he attributed to falling asleep at the wheel, and an accumulation of rejections and disappointments." Are those red flags for going into the military, or are there people in the military? And we have heard that there are more in the military now because we are fighting these wars that are going on for a long period of time, and we need to find soldiers. Did you find when you were there that there were people there who maybe not have been?
You know, the type of personality of a person that joins the military is usually one of those type of people that likes to live their life on the edge. You know, they like to do things dangerous and fast and dangerous. This is the present day military. I mean, I knew a lot of guys that had, you know, been arrested. They had other problems, you know, speeding tickets, whatever. And then when you get in the military, it's amplified because you're surrounded with the people with the same exact mentality and the same exact type of personality, and I don't think that's unique to the soldiers that have deployed. I think if anything, it amplifies it because they've been to the edge and they feel like they almost are afraid that they're not going to be able to experience that again, and they do it to push the limit, push the envelope.
Some psychiatrists have said that if you see one of your fellow soldiers killed or hurt in a substantial way, that experience can throw you into a blind rage. What does that phrase blind rage mean to you? And can you imagine somebody being in such a blind rage that they would carry out an atrocity on the people that they were really trying to defend?
You know, as far as seeing another soldier die, I mean, you spend your everyday life, you're in the war zone, and you're spending all your time working together. They're like your brothers, and when you see them die or you see them injured, it causes a lot of rage because one, they're your friend, but two, you're thinking that could have been me.
Right.
And then some people even think, why not me? Why him? Why not me? And so, a lot of the way that we treat the indigenous people of these countries that we go to, we don't treat them with much respect. There's almost a racism there. Like they're not civilized like us, you know. I mean, Afghanistan, like the quality of living there is so low, and especially with the language barrier, you can't openly communicate with them, and people get enraged by that because somebody that they consider to be lower than them has taken something away from them that's so precious that I could see the blind rage.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Here's how you become a part of our conversation. Zach Laporte, an Iraq War veteran, former machine gun leader in an infantry platoon for the U.S. Army, is our guest this hour as we try to understand, if it's possible to do so, why a soldier would commit the kind of atrocity, the massacre of Afghan villagers that took place in Afghanistan. And we're trying to understand who he is and if there were any signs in his past that this kind of thing could have happened and what it is that happens during war that can lodge itself so deeply in a person's mind that can make a person lose his or her mind. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Zach was sent to Iraq in the spring of 2005, and he was redeployed in the fall of 2006. Our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. Our number is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program. His most famous case was defending John Scopes, but he had over 2,000 cases. One-third or more of them earned him nothing. A famous case was in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, where Thomas Kidd, an organizer, put on trial for leading a conspiracy to destroy the Payne Lumber Company by helping to organize a strike of its employees. Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. A terrific book and an amazingly complicated and interesting man, hour two of our show. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Ray in Milwaukee. Hello, Ray.
Hi. I'd like to start with how we define the term war. Throughout history, wars have been generally where one side loses a large amount of people, and so does the other side. But these two occupations have been 1,000 to 1, 10,000 to 1. We're not sure of the numbers of the civilians we've killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I'd like the guests to know that there's more than one way to be patriotic, sir. You don't just have to pick up a gun. Maybe you could have started reading your Bible.
Zach?
I totally agree with you. I felt at the time, I was 19 years old, I felt like, the best way for me to do it was to serve my country, and there are plenty of ways to serve your country. It's taken me about 10 years now to figure that out. I feel like that's what I'm trying to do right now is by raising awareness that these wars are needless. We don't need them. I'm not a religious person, so I wouldn't read the Bible, but I think that a lot of people can, that if that's what they want to do, then that's what they can do. And whether it's serving your community or doing something, volunteering at a homeless shelter, whatever. We have an organization in Milwaukee called the Veterans Homeless Initiative, and what they do is they seek out veterans that are in need, and they go and they bring them meals and food and all that type of stuff, and they really try and help them out, because a large portion of the homeless in our society are veterans, and it's really quite unfortunate.
Boyd in Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Hello to your guests. First off, I do want to commend you for your service. I never served myself. I never was a veteran. So I can't empathize what the veterans go through, but I've talked with enough of them, and one thing I've come to realize is whether you go to a military school or boot camp and what have you, the best kind of military institutions, I believe they can teach you a lot of things, but they can never, ever prepare you for combat. You can play as many games of capture the flag as you want, but when you're out there and in the distance, you see someone or a group of people maybe 100 to 200 yards away, and okay, they're going to kill me if I don't do something, and then you feel that bullet just whiz by you. This was told to me by a gentleman who I was talking with who's still in the Army. He's career. He's been in there for 30 years, but, he completely agreed. Nothing can compare you for combat. And I guess that's all I wanted to say. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Boyd.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, that's kind of what I said. You don't really know what combat is going to feel like. You can read books, you can watch movies, and you're never fully going to understand it until that first bullet flies by your head and it's so close. You can hear a snapping sound because the bullet will break the speed the the sound barrier as it travels past you, and if it's close enough, you'll hear a snap. The first time you hear that snap, you don't even think about it. You just know that you have to react and you have to do whatever it takes to survive.
Ken on Highway 51. Hi, Ken.
Hello, ma'am. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I spent 4 years deployed. I was in the Army since 2000. I got out in 2008. I spent 4.5 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm. And a lot of that was in pretty heavy combat. And the whole thing is, and I've heard some of your guests say there's other ways to be more patriotic. But we're Americans. We're better. We're better than a lot of the things that happen. And it's not a racism. It's not looking down on people. It's the reason we don't attack people in cities. We're better than that. And that's why this hasn't happened yet. There's a high sense of honor among the American soldier that we're just not out there on rampages killing people. We're out there for a purpose.
What do you think of the recent events that have happened in Afghanistan, Ken? What do you think of the massacre? What do you think of the urinating on the Quran? There have been some incidents, high-profile incidents recently. Are those just isolated incidents? But the fact that they've received so much attention has made us think about this war. I guess I'm asking you a couple of questions. Is that right for us to be looking at these seriously?
Oh, yeah, I think they should, of course, be looked at seriously. But these are one person that's snapping. It's not the American veteran. It's hard enough coming home. Now these are going to add to everybody thinking we're crazy veterans coming home, and it's also going to add to everybody thinking we're over there massacring people. That's not the case. It's not like that at all.
Do you know people who have snapped, Ken?
Yes. Yeah, but nobody that went out and did a murderous rampage.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense of rage that happens. I've lost dear friends over there. One of my friends, if you go to the Madison VA, his picture's on the wall because he was lost in the Coringall Valley last year.
Hmm.
Or 2 years ago, I'm sorry, since I've been a while since I got out. But it's now you have an incident like this that every Taliban or insurgent that we killed, all the good that we did, some people might not consider that good, but when they're doing bad things, sometimes they have to be taken care of. When we put in water pipeline projects, when we build schools, every good thing that we did is overshadowed by one bad apple now that lost his control and his composure and did not act like an American soldier and went out and committed murder.
Zach.
I have to agree with you in some respect. I feel like the fact that we're putting our soldiers, sailors, and airmen in this situation to have the ability to do this, I think that it's something that we have to really look ourselves in the mirror as a country and figure out, are these the values that we represent? Do we represent the values of having an occupation of a country that should be treated as a sovereign nation? Should we honestly be interfering with that? And I guess that's a question for another time.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask both of you, and let me ask you this first, Ken. The issue, this is one that's hard for me to understand. People do crazy things under alcohol, but alcohol has been brought up in this case, and the question has been asked how much a role alcohol may have played in the attack. Is that a question worth asking, and is there a significant amount of drinking going on and drugs being used among our soldiers, first in Iraq and now in Afghanistan?
I've never seen alcohol. I heard of a friend of mine or whatever that would have it sent over to him in a Listerine bottle, but I never knew of it being a factor in anything. And drug testing it's almost from my unit. I was in a decent unit, I think. We did not know of it because we tested. I was actually we called it the unit prevention leader. It was my job to go around to all the obscure fire posts and combat outposts and collect drug urine samples from people to send to Hawaii for sampling. So the Army takes that very seriously, and they continue to test drugs.
Uh-huh. Zach, same experience for you?
Yeah, we had basically random drug testing every time we got back from deployment and every time before we deployed, and they were pretty good at weeding people out that were using drugs. As far as alcohol goes, though, in the United States, alcoholism was I would usually consider it was encouraged, whereas when you're deployed, it's almost impossible to get. We had a couple times where an interpreter could go outside of our compound and he'd come back with a couple bottles for soldiers that would give him a certain amount of money. But yeah, alcoholism alcohol in the combat zone and then drugs just in general, the Army does a pretty good job of cleaning that stuff up.
And Ken, a final question for you. Was the transition to civilian life difficult for you?
Oh, of course. I go to school now in Stevens Point. I study wildlife ecology.
And oh, great.
We have the veterans counselor there, Ann Whipp. She is just fantastic, and she makes dealing with the VA bureaucracy so much easier because it's a government organization. You can't have a large organization without a lot of paperwork. And I've received help from the Madison VA hospital because I got slightly wounded in 2008, and you know they've been nothing but great. My only complaint about the VA hospital is that there's not enough of them. They are some of the best and most caring doctors I've ever had.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so glad to hear you're studying wildlife ecology. What a nice change of life for you, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I also have a law enforcement minor, so I'm in the academy right now, and so taking that's actually the hardest part, because when you go to fill out job applications or the psychological assessments for this, you know how to game the system. You know how to answer the questions the way they want. And it's also, how do you say yes, I'm a veteran, I'm very disciplined, I should be on one of your top candidates, yet, you know, I could answer a question wrong and be considered the crazy veteran right away.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ken. I'm glad you were listening. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Did you have a similar experience, Zach, with a VA? Were people helpful?
As far as going down to the hospital, I had a very positive experience going to the VA. They're very accommodating, especially with you know, they know Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are coming back in large numbers, and they really are trying to give them priority. You get 5 years of health services through the VA after you separate from the military, and that's just, I mean, you can't ask for much better than that. You know, even I would get hurt. I would hurt myself, like, because you would think that normally it would only be service connected help, where I hurt myself outside in college or whatever, and had to get a wound cleaned out and everything, and I went down there and they just took care of it. You know, they just asked a couple questions and it was free and provided for veterans, and even like I said, the counseling and everything. You know, they don't charge you anything. They just do it for you because they know that you need it.
Hmm. Ken, thanks for your call. Dr. Brian in Door County. Hi.
Yes. Good morning, Kathleen. Ken, thank you. You appear to be doing as well as any, better than most.
This is Zach. Just so you know, this is Zach. Ken just hung up.
Zach.
It's all right.
And all the vets out there, keep working at it. The reason the military exists is to control. Their job is to control by domination, and that's exercising fear. And what they do is they, for lack of a better way, they program, they condition, they brainwash the vets, or I should say the soldiers in boot camp, to understand how control works and manifest that control on others. And when they go into the theater, their job is essentially to control the situation. And when it comes to what they are told the enemy, they have to dehumanize the enemy. They have to literally think of them other than being human. And that's the way they survive. And they also survive by working with each other, by depending on each other, and by protecting each other. That's a they are taught to befriend and love each other to a point where they will take care of each other, do anything it takes to protect each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between genders. Men, for instance, are more likely to rush a machine gun nest, whereas a female won't. Much of this is explained in the great book, the treatise titled Why We Kill. Are you familiar with that, Zach?
No, but I would like to read it.
It's a tremendous book written just within the past several years. I believe the author were a military psychologist, and it's a great compendium. I apologize, I don't remember the author's name. But terrific show, Kathleen. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Bruce is next. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. Let me preface this by saying that I personally have had no military experience, but I have the greatest respect and gratitude to those who do serve. My thinking is that a lot of the problem with these insane multiple redeployments is due to the fact that we have an all-volunteer army or military and that we do not have a draft in this country. And I think the reason that we don't have a draft in this country to provide adequate personnel so that we don't have to keep recycling these troops over and over and over again until they're so broken that they can't be used anymore is the fact that since World War II, we haven't had a constitutionally declared war in this country. Korea was a United Nations police effort. Vietnam was not constitutionally declared war by Congress. Neither was they were done by mandate, presidential decree. And I think if we had a draft in this country, it would force Congress, the war makers, to really, really think real hard about what they were doing and really put some responsibility on them to make the right decisions. I don't think the American people, number one, would support a draft. I don't think the young people who would be directly affected by a draft would support it. I think it would take a really legitimate reason for us to go to war in a foreign country, such as we did in World War II, which was probably the last legitimate war that we were in. I just think that without a draft, without some responsibility, when it's too easy to declare war, it just keeps going the way it has been.
Zach,
I agree. I think if there were to be a draft, I think it would be so unpopular that people would be protesting in the streets. I think the government learned their lesson in the 60s, and I think this war would be a lot more unpopular. I mean, it's already unpopular, but you don't see people marching in the streets trying to end it. I mean, that's largely because of the fact that there isn't a draft, and also that there isn't as high of a casualty count as there was during Vietnam. But yeah, I totally agree. We never constitutionally declared war, so that's my response to that.
I'm interested because of your experience. You were a former machine gun team leader in an infantry platoon. In all that's being written about this, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales, they've interviewed a number of people who have studied post-traumatic stress. One of them, a medical director for the Brain Injury Association of America, talked about a small minority of people with PTSD engaging in abusive violence. He went on and said that to be a sniper, you've got to have the ultimate in impulse control. You have to move slowly. You have to inhibit. You have to wait to put the brakes on, even in situations where the heart is pounding and it's a high-stress environment. Your situation in the Army would have led you to be in exactly those situations. Can you describe what it's like to be in that kind of environment and how you deal with impulse control in that kind of environment?
Well, a lot of the time, your decision-making process, it comes down to being able to distinguish between something that's a threat and something that's not a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very difficult to do in an environment when your enemy is not, you know, they're not wearing a uniform that says Al-Qaeda. They're wearing civilian clothes. They might be wearing a vest underneath their clothes. You honestly have such a difficult time doing, and the way you can distinguish usually is if you tell them to stop. You know you go through a series of progressions. They're coming at you, and you say to them in Arabic, you say stop, and if they don't stop, you give them a light, like a flash of light, and then you do a warning shot, and if they're still coming, then you're clear to engage, and they try and create that process to make it easy to make that decision. You know, if you go through your progressions and they don't stop, then you have to make that decision at the last possible moment.
The stress involved in that must be phenomenal, almost incomprehensible.
It is, because I looked at most of the population that I encountered, you know, and one of the callers said that you have to deal with them, you have to dehumanize them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the problems that I had. I could never dehumanize any of them, and they were always people to me. I always wondered, you know, whose dad is this? Whose brother is this? Whose mother? Whose sister? Whose daughter? And I always wondered that. And that's one of the things that still haunts me to this day.
Oh my, what a statement that is. You wondered who their family was.
Mm. Yeah, and a lot of times, I mean, like I said, I was in a special operations unit. And so what we would do is we would go to a suspected insurgent, a suspected Al-Qaeda. We would go to the location where we thought they were. We would go there somewhere between the hours of midnight and 4 o'clock in the morning. And we would, you know, we'd break down their door. We'd set up security positions around. We'd clear the entire house. We'd take them, we'd take the occupants of the house. We would put them into separated rooms. You know, we'd separate the men from the women. And then we'd go through, we'd have one team would interrogate them, would interrogate the military age males, and then we'd have another team that would search the house for certain types of intelligence that we were looking for. And depending on what we found or what the detainees would tell us, that would determine whether or not we brought them back to our compound and did further interrogation, or whether we did a follow-on mission. But most of the time, you know, we would get there and we would have faulty information. You know, there were, I don't know how many times we hit the wrong, we would go to the wrong house, and it was kind of disappointing because you want to believe when you go over there that you're doing the right thing and that you're there to protect them and you're there to do all this stuff, but then you go into their house and you tear apart their entire house. You cut their mattresses in half.
Mm.
You break their cabinets. You break their televisions. You do all that kind of stuff because the things you're looking for are not, you know, it's not like a bit, you're not going to find a big briefcase full of documents. You're going to find like a little, you know, SIM card for a telephone or a memory card for a thumb drive or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking for these little things and you literally tear their entire house apart looking for it. And if you hit the wrong place, you apologize, you give them, you know, about, I think it was like $15 or $20 US for their trouble.
Mm. Zach Laporte is our guest this hour, Iraq War veteran. Our number is 800-486-8655. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Clarence Darrow, attorney for the damned. John Farrell, the author of a large new biography of the famed lawyer, will be with us hour two. It should be a good hour. Karen in Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. Okay, thank you, Kathleen, for this wonderful program, and thank you, Zach. This has been so informative. I am the daughter of a dad who was drafted into the Navy during World War II and served as a gunner on a destroyer and was wounded. My husband was drafted in 1966 during the Vietnam era, a couple months after we were married, and ended up enlisting in the Air Force so we would have a little bit better chance of staying together, and served for 4 years. My son enlisted in the Marine Corps during the first Gulf War and served. My husband has said always, although it was not his favorite 4 years of his life, he says that he supports the idea of a draft because those who serve in the military have a much better understanding of what goes on in the military, of how it works, and of the damage that war can cause. We know so many veterans who are opposed to war and have been opposed since they came home from whatever war it was. And I heard a woman either on Minnesota or Wisconsin Public Radio or read this in the newspaper just recently talking about the sergeant who did the massacre. And she was saying she didn't know about what was going on with that case, but she said now is the time to put war on trial and ask ourselves. And one of the callers who called in about the draft mentioned that, you know, we would be so much less likely to go into these wars if we had people, both who had served, making the decisions in Congress. Many of them have not. And if we also had a populace that was affected by anyone being called. I remember the Vietnam era so well. And that war finally ended because so many of our friends and neighbors were killed in that war. It was not laid on the shoulders of volunteers. Thank you so much for this program.
Thank you, Karen, for your important call. Zach?
I think she raises an interesting point that she said her husband supports a draft so that, you know, everybody can understand the military better. And you know, I think I know Israel has, you know, every person that has to serve in the military in Israel. I don't support that type of policy in the United States. You know, it would make our military larger, but I think it would make it easier to send them off to war. And I think every time we deploy our soldiers into harm's way, we have to ask that question: like, is this something that is really necessary for the freedom and liberty of the United States of America? And it's been a long time, I think, since we've seen a war that where you could answer that question and say yes.
Let's go to Carl in Boulder Junction. Hi, Carl.
Thanks for taking my call. I just was curious from another perspective when you see just in society in general, if you, like most people that listen to this radio station, do pay attention to the headlines where our children go into schools and shoot a number of their classmates, people go into courthouses and shoot a number of people on the courthouse steps. I mean, it seems to happen weekly, if not almost, you know, it's crazy. And I guess the question, considering what position soldiers are put in, the question may be more appropriate is how can this not happen more? I think it's possibly just down to the individual because, like I said, you see it just in day-to-day life. And thank you for the program, and I'll listen off the air.
Thanks, Carl. Zach?
The one thing that separates these school shooters and the courthouse shooters from the men and women of the military is that the men and women of the military go through, depending on the service, 8 to 16 weeks of rigorous firearms training where they learn discipline, they learn how to use each particular weapon and how to respect it. And I think that's very important because they fully understand the ramifications of using these firearms. And I'm not sure exactly how to compare this to the other level, but I think to the other, the comparison of the school shooters and such, but you know, the men and women are of the military are instilled this discipline in it, and I'm not quite sure you could find that in the general populace, because the general populace is much larger than the U.S. military by far.
Thank you.
I'm not sure how else to react to that.
Yeah, you know, well, he's asking you to take on violence in society, which is another whole issue, maybe related, maybe not. Zach, thank you so much for being with us. It was very important to hear what you had to say, and I thank you. You're very articulate and caring, and we wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Zach LaPorte, an Iraq War veteran. He is from Spooner, Wisconsin, beautiful part of the state. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour and Katie Mattson for on-air production. We'll return.